From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 600,000 international students are studying in American universities. More students come to the United States for graduate studies than to any other country in the world. But America's famous allure to the world's best and brightest is dimming. Last year alone, American graduate programs saw an almost 30% decline in applications from students abroad. That is in part because the best students in China, India, Korea, and elsewhere can increasingly get a top education and a top job in their own countries or in other countries eager to lay out the welcome mat, including Canada and Britain. But it is also because some American security measures since 9/11 have shown would-be student visitors, including some of the world's very finest, a face that is unfriendly, even frightening. Some say the United States has become unattractive to many of the very minds that will drive science, innovation, and economic growth in the 21st century. Tonight on Point, America's vanishing foreign students and what their absence means for U.S. competitiveness in the global economy. You can join the conversation tonight. What does America lose when it loses top foreign students? Is America making itself unnecessarily unappealing to the best and brightest abroad? What's the right balance between security and openness when it comes to attracting international talent? And why aren't more Americans filling the university ranks in science and engineering? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We will hear tonight from top figures in American academia and from the worried former chairman and CEO of Lockheed Martin. But first, joining me now from New York is Peggy Blumenthal. She's vice president for educational services at the Institute of International Education. She's been following the decline in international student applications to America's universities. Peggy Blumenthal, thanks for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure.
So give us the picture. We've got a couple of numbers I've dropped out here, but what are the trends? What are the trend lines?
Well, it is true that for the first time in 30 years, the number of international students actually went down last year 2.4%, and that is extremely worrying, particularly if it's the beginning of a long slide. It's a little soon to tell what's the long-term trend, but as you said, the number of applications has dropped quite sharply. What we don't know, and we're all waiting to see, is whether the number of actual admissions keeps going down, and therefore the overall numbers will go down. What we do know is that many other international countries are trying to attract foreign students we're looking for, the British and the Australians, the Canadians, as you said. And we also know, as you said, that many home countries such as China and India are increasing their own ability to deliver graduate education at a high level.
And some really remarkable numbers here. As I look at these applications for the fall 2004 term, that was last fall,
yep.
Applications for American graduate programs from China down 45%. That's almost half. India, 30%. Overall, nearly 30%, 28%. Those seem like very steep drops. And, of course, graduate programs, particularly in science and engineering, are where so many researchers have come from that have ended up, being the brain power for an awful lot of American enterprise.
Well, it's true. But what we don't know is whether those drops in applications are the drops from students who we really would like to accept, or whether they're the many hundreds and thousands of students who apply and are never going to get accepted anyway. So it's a little soon to be sure that the quality of U.S. graduate education from international students is dropping as precipitously as the applications are dropping. I think what you said earlier, that the visa application, the tightening of visa restrictions, has certainly discouraged a lot of students. Some of them never would have gotten an acceptance anyway, but some of them would have and are choosing to maybe look elsewhere or stay home.
Fill in that picture for us. China and India, those economies, Korea, others, have clearly become more attractive places to stay. Students may not feel the same compulsion to go abroad. And we're seeing many other countries that are quite deliberately targeting that global flow of the best and the brightest that the United States has enjoyed for so long. But what about American security policy, America visa policy in the years after 9/11? How big an impediment to applications, to a sense of welcome, has that been?
Well, immediately after September 11, there were serious tightening of the visa review process, as there needed to be, because we wanted to make absolutely sure that nobody was coming who wasn't a legitimate student. The problem was that the word got out that it was impossible to get a visa, and since then, many, many students have not even bothered to try. In fact, in the last 6 months or so, the U.S. government has taken a number of steps to speed up the visa process, particularly for students, and to make sure that they get a timely review and that they get accepted. But the word on the street in China, in India, and Korea is still, you know, what happened to their cousin or their brother 2 years ago. So we've got a perception problem and we've got a reality problem. We've got to fight those both.
A hit to the U.S. reputation as the place to go, as a welcoming place to go. Peggy Blumenthal, stand by if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation from Bethesda, Maryland, Norman Augustine, former chairman and CEO of Lockheed Martin, the world's largest defense contractor, builds fighter jets, submarines, satellites, surveillance system. He retired from the board there last month and has just come out recently with an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal saying, we don't have enough PhDs in this country. Norman Augustine, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Nice to be here.
You're concerned about the brain power that the United States is going to bring to its competitive challenges. How important is that flow, has been that flow, of international students into American universities, into American corporations?
Well, it's been extremely important. First of all, just the importance of science and technology. Any number of studies have shown that over half the jobs that have been created in America during the last half century have their roots in science and technology and investments in those fields. And today, about 38% of the people having doctorates and working in the science and technology workforce in America were foreign-born. In the past, we've relied heavily on foreign-born people. We've attracted them to our universities. But things have changed in the last few years. We now, as we've heard, have fewer applicants, mm-hmm. and furthermore, graduates, fewer of them are remaining in America. Part of this, I think, is that foreign educations have improved, opportunities have improved abroad. Many foreign universities are now teaching their science and technology courses in English to try to attract mm-hmm. Students from around the world. There's also a problem that American students, in many cases, either aren't qualified or simply aren't attracted to science and engineering careers. So when you add this together, you have kind of a perfect storm forming.
When you look forward to this century that we've now entered, Norman Augustine, with the clearly evident competition coming at the United States from China, from India, and many others at this point, how do you picture the consequences for the U.S. economy, the U.S. standard of living, if those international students who have traditionally come here in such great numbers, and so many of them stayed, if that continues to dwindle? What might the consequences be?
Well, I think the consequences are very serious. Many of the problems that our nation faces, in fact, the world faces, the solutions really are in the roots, have their roots in science and technology. And that's true whether you talk about providing energy or home and security or building an economy or healthcare, any number of challenges we face. And there are really only two solutions to obtaining more scientists and engineers. One is attract more Americans into those fields, and the other is, as we have in the past, is to attract more foreign students into our universities and attract them into remaining in our workforce. And the former is made very difficult by the, frankly, generally poor state of education in the K-12 system in America when it comes to science and technology.
Mm. So there's been such a reliance on brain power from abroad. The security issue has become a stumbling block here because, of course, after 9/11, immigration and then the Department of Homeland Security felt obliged to tighten up. But is there a security downside, Norman Augustine? You headed up a defense contractor. Could you have, will Lockheed Martin be able to do its work if it doesn't have that flow of engineers and scientists from abroad?
The case of national security is an interesting one because in most cases the employees require security clearances that foreign nationals can't obtain. So American companies in the national defense arena really depend upon American citizens, whether they be newly minted citizens or born in this country. On the other hand, the economy as a whole is dependent increasingly on foreign-born scientists and engineers. After 9/11, immediately thereafter, we discovered that there were many individuals in our country who'd come in on student visas who had not registered in universities and nobody knew where they were.
Mm-hmm.
So there were very good reasons to be concerned. And I would never argue that we should give special or lower the standards in terms of security to admit people in the educational system in America because they were interested in science and engineering. I would, however, argue that we should streamline the processing of our visa system and probably give priority to those who are interested in science and engineering simply because that's a need of America.
And Abigneen, Norman Augustine, former chairman and CEO of Lockheed Martin, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Peggy Blumenthal, what about that flow, the efficiency of processing those applications from abroad? It got so tangled for a while that just simply, as you said, turned people off. Is it getting better?
It is getting better, and we know that both from some policy decisions that have been made and also from the statistics that are coming from big embassies, the U.S. embassy in China and in India and other countries. They are speeding student applications, putting them at the front of the queue because they need to get here by a certain date, whereas someone coming on a tourist visa, maybe it doesn't matter so much. They have loosened the requirements that the students have to go back and renew their visas after a certain period. They've tried to do a lot of things to streamline it. But the problem now is the perception problem. The word isn't getting out fast enough to international students, and many of us are going on radio internationally and trying to make speeches and reach those students to let them know that things have changed since September 11, and people are now, U.S. campuses are reaching out to international students, and people in Congress and people in the administration and certainly the business community are very aware that we want more international students.
It's good to hear, but we're still also hearing horror stories from foreign students, very highly talented ones, who want to get into this country. We'll hear more about that tonight. Peggy Blumenthal, thanks so much for being with us. Stick with us here. We're going to take a short break. We're talking tonight about America's shrinking appeal to students from abroad and the price to the U.S. economy when the world's best and brightest stay home or go elsewhere. You can join the conversation tonight. What does America lose when it loses international students in its universities? And if the best and brightest stay home or go elsewhere, what's the cost to American science and innovation, to the U.S. economy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's tarnished welcome mat for international students and the high price of blunt security measures at the U.S. border and beyond. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? What is the right balance between American security and openness when it comes to the international flow of young talent? And let me put a call out to international students. What has your experience been in post-9/11 America? Good? Bad? Ugly? Do you feel welcome? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking tonight with Peggy Blumenthal, at the Vice President for Educational Services at the Institute of International Education. We're joined now from Boulder, Colorado, by Lawrence Bell. He's Director of the International Education Office at the University of Colorado at Boulder and is Vice President for Public Policy at NAFSA, the Association of International Educators. Lawrence Bell, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm reading testimony that you recently gave before Congress, and it's a big mural that you paint here, but some of this is very tough. You talk about a dysfunctional relationship between the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security. You write about what was sort of bad coordination, bad approach to security and screening after 9/11 that you say could not have written a worse prescription for disaster, and that was pretty much what occurred. Take us down to an international student's eye level for a minute and describe for us, if you would, Lawrence Bell, what is it that built so quickly such a bad reputation that so many people decided maybe not even to apply? What kind of experiences did international students trying to come to the States have?
Well, it's a combination of factors, Tom. When they go in to apply for the visa, there were delays in getting appointments early on after 9/11. Much of that has been taken care of. Progress has been made, particularly in that area. But they had trouble getting appointments. When they got appointments and went through the interview process, sometimes were made to feel unwelcome in applying to come to the United States. And the biggest problem was the security clearances, the clearance needed to come to the United States. And although that's an important step, it was such a large volume of clearances that had to be made in such a short period of time that I don't think anybody would argue that State or Homeland Security were ready for that volume at that period of time.
But a couple of delayed interviews at embassies or consulates abroad, that doesn't sound so bad. I mean, are international students so thin-skinned that that's all it took to turn them away from the United States to Australia or Britain, Canada? Is that all it took?
Well, I'm not sure that that's all it took, but it certainly did have an impact on students who were trying to come here. Many of them were delayed long enough that they missed the start of their classes. Some of them were expected as teaching assistants or research assistants, and they were unable to accept those assistantships because they couldn't get here for the start of their program. So it was more than just some short delays. They were months long, and in some cases, year long and longer.
Do international students in the United States feel safe today? I mean, do they look at Guantanamo Bay and say, uh-oh, if I'm from the wrong country and say the wrong thing, I could end up there?
I don't think it's a matter of feeling safe. I do think it's an issue, as Peggy mentioned, of feeling welcome. There are, in the visa delays and the tracking system that is in place through Homeland Security and other issues that make them feel less than a welcome part of the academic community, not the institutions themselves. We have bent over backwards to assure them that they are welcome and wanted, but it's the pieces that happen in between, delays with Social Security issuance, delays with driver's license issuance, all sorts of things are creating a perception, at least, if not a reality, that we have an access problem, that it's real hard for students and scholars to have access to the academic programs they desire.
And some pretty tough interrogations right at the border, from what I've heard. Maybe necessary, but certainly no fun, and maybe not always very subtle in their focus. Lawrence Bell, Peggy Blumenthal, please stand by. From Berkeley, California, I want to welcome into our conversation Robert Bergineau. He's former dean of science at MIT. He is now chancellor at the University of California, Berkeley. Robert Bergineau, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
So here we're talking about the problem of a kind of shrinking international student interest in the United States. How big a deal is this, Robert Bergineau?
Well, here at Berkeley, we think that this is really a critical issue. International graduate students represent approximately a third of our PhD students altogether. And if you look, for example, at Silicon Valley, I'll give a specific example. In Silicon Valley, over a period of time at the end of the 90s, fully 30% of the CEOs were born in either India or China and came to the United States as graduate students. If we lose those 30%, that will have a devastating effect on not just the California economy, but the economy of the United States as a whole.
And what have you seen in the last couple of years at Berkeley? Have you also felt this hesitation, even just absence, AWOL, of international students deciding to stay home or study elsewhere, not in the USA?
Well, we've seen two parts. One is we've seen a significant decline in the numbers of international graduate students who have come here. But secondly, which I think is equally important, and here I'll confirm comments you've already had, many of those students feel that they've gone through such an insulting process, usually caused by individual people at the consular offices, that people who start out very pro-American end up with very mixed, if not anti-American, feelings.
I mean, young people who are likely to be prominent in whatever their field is, given their position, being turned anti-American just by the screening that goes on.
Correct. So I spent some time in Toronto, and I have a Turkish Muslim graduate student who goes back and forth between the United States and Canada. And he's, when he tries to cross the border, is regularly pulled aside, taken off into a room, and grilled for several hours. He's the sweetest young man you could ever meet, extremely talented. And before 9/11 and the introduction of these new policies, was very pro-American.
Robert Bergineau, what would you say to an American listening tonight who says, hey, wait a minute, an awful lot, if not all, of those hijackers on 9/11 had student visas. We've got almost 300 million Americans here. Surely that's enough to draw from. We've got a security problem. We don't really need these international students. Let's educate our own American students, have the security we need, and have Americans doing the jobs.
The United States is became a great country as a country of immigration, and we've always been open to the most talented people worldwide. And does this mean, as a result of 9/11, that we're going to close our borders and reject all of the talent. That would fundamentally change the character of American society, and I think it would be a great loss.
And in the global economy, if those students continue not to come, if they go instead to school in New Zealand and London and Toronto, do you see a real material downside for the U.S.?
As I gave an example earlier of the huge
Silicon Valley, 30%, yep.
Right, of that foreign workers have had on our economy. I'll give you another example. I served some time ago on a committee at Los Alamos that was looking after our national security, and so this was a high-end committee, deeply scientific and engineering committee, deeply interested in national security issues and guaranteeing the security of the United States. We did a count on the committee, and it turned out that 8 out of the 13 people on the committee were foreign-born and had come to the United States as international graduate students.
Wow.
So here we have a high-end committee deeply committed to the American vision and to American national security, and 8 out of the 13 would have been missing if we started excluding international graduate students.
That is a lot of empty seats at the table. Robert Bergineau, Chancellor, University of California, Berkeley, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Robert Bergineau, former Dean of Science at MIT. Peggy Blumenthal, there's a pretty strong plea from a pretty high-placed American scientist saying we've got to have this flow coming.
Absolutely, and I think there's no disagreement about that. I did want to just make a small correction. Only one of the hijackers was known to have a student visa, and that was not someone who came as a legitimate student, but someone who was abusing the student visa process to try to sneak
in. Thank you
in.
For that correction.
So I think it's, but the problem, you and I think the media in general got this impression somehow that a whole lot of foreign students were involved in this.
I guess from the flight school connection,
yes.
Must be of what cultivated
right,
that, but you're saying no,
exactly,
please
some
no.
Some of them snuck in, and weren't really students. Students are actually the most closely monitored foreign visitors that we have. I mean, the schools screen them first and only let them in if they have a legitimate record. Then the consular office screens them. Then every minute they're in the United States, they are tracked through this CVIS system. And it's actually, you know, tourists and business people who can come in and go much more easily. So part of, I think the American higher education community is saying, look, you know, the problem isn't with students. The problem is making sure that everybody who comes is closely screened. And students shouldn't be put through special hoops because actually students have more of a contribution to make in the long term to our economy than any other sector of the international visitor.
We need them. Let's hear another voice from that higher education community. Joining us now from Tempe, Arizona, is Michael Crow. He's president of Arizona State University. He spearheaded many initiatives there, including the creation of a biodesign institute to increase the university's focus on cutting-edge research. Michael Crow, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
We've heard just now from Robert Bergineau at Berkeley, formerly at MIT, of his concerns about the sort of missing people at the table when international students don't come. What's your experience at Arizona State at this point, Michael Crow? Has the U.S. government found the right balance of security and openness, or is the ship still out of whack?
I think the ship is still out of whack. Our seed corn, if you will, great thinkers from all over the world are being left out and are finding a very difficult time of getting into the United States, and it's hurting us scientifically and technically very much right now.
What's the direct impact been at Arizona State?
We're down probably 30% in international graduate students, particularly from those countries that have been a steady source for 4 or 5 decades.
That sounds huge, 30%. I mean, it's enormous.
It is a large number of individuals, and they're top quality, top flight individuals.
Do American students step up to fill those places, or do you just end up having smaller departments, smaller number of graduates coming out?
Well, in some cases, American students step up, but what happens is that there might be some reduction in the caliber of the students. We look to fill the graduate schools with the top quality students, and so now we may be going with some lesser quality students.
And what does it mean for your programs, for the quality of your research?
Well, I think most importantly what it means is you get individuals who are less intense and less committed, perhaps, or you get fewer individuals, which means as we staff up in certain areas, it's harder to keep the teams moving in the direction we'd like to move them. But I think most importantly, we're affecting the pipeline of people that leave the university, stay in the United States, and do great things.
What would you like to see change in the way foreign students are processed, the way they're screened, the way they're brought into the United States, President Crow?
I think what we need to do is we need to have a system which allows students to be quickly evaluated We need students to be treated based on their academic merit, and if they have other issues, then they can be sent to the side for special consideration. But 99% or more of the students have only academic considerations to put on the table, and those people need to move through more quickly.
Are you optimistic that the U.S. government, the Department of Homeland Security, which now runs immigration, is moving in that direction? Are they focused on the same goal?
They're not focused yet on the same goal. I mean, they have obviously intense focus on national security, and that's a very complicated set of issues, but I don't think that they fully have grasped the impact that they're having in the competitive marketplace. You've got other countries, New Zealand, Australia, England, and elsewhere, advertising directly against the United States right now, trying to gain advantage, and folks in INS need to be paying close attention to that also.
And can those countries really compete with the United States at the level of research that students would like to participate in? Can they show the same quality of program?
They can't in volume, but what they can do is they can cherry-pick off the top and bring in the best students. And that will hurt us in the long run.
Michael Crow, president of Arizona State University, joining us from Tempe, Arizona. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
I want to turn to our callers. Shamil is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Shamil, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Good evening.
Yeah, I wanted to just mention the point regarding the economy of China and India. They're booming, so the opportunity cost for an education may be high now. Would that have anything to do with it?
I'm sure it would, but let me put it to our panel here, Shamil, and thanks for your call. Lawrence Bell, how about it? Do we just see such hot economies in India and China that they don't need to come to the United States? I've seen in India some Indian students deciding not even to go to university. They've got such great opportunities.
Certainly that plays into the mix, and in China they're building graduate education in order to accommodate that, but I'm not sure how much that plays into the mix.
I mean,
it's a piece of it, to be sure.
I mean, long term, let's say that the welcome mat issue wasn't there. If you pulled aside 9/11, would the U.S. still have a diminishing appeal to international students long term? Is there an advantage that can be sustained here, or is it will there be an inevitable leavening? Peggy Blumenthal, are we going to see American students going to Shanghai in large numbers?
Well, we are starting to see that more students are studying all over the world. I'm an optimist because I think the pressure for higher education is just going to grow and grow all over the world, and there aren't enough seats anywhere in the world to accommodate that. And America has the highest number of educational institutions and the greatest variety of educational institutions. So I think we are going to see a rebound. I think that, as all of the speakers have said, there was a real bottleneck right after September 11. The word got out that it was difficult, if not impossible, to get in. And the numbers have shown that drop. But long term, I do believe that America is going to be the destination of choice, particularly for students in science and technology, because we have the widest variety of research institutions with financial ability to pay these outstanding students to be research assistants and teaching assistants. If that doesn't happen, as everybody says, then not only will the schools suffer and the economy will suffer, but the American students will suffer because they won't get to interact with their global peers. And that will be their loss as well as the foreign students' loss.
Lawrence Bell, are you equally sanguine about the long-term prospects here? Is it kind of inevitable that this wave flow of students comes back to the United States, or are there changes the U.S. is now going to have to make to keep that brain power coming?
I really do think that we need to accommodate the change in the marketplace. It's a much more competitive market than it was in the past in terms of graduate education in particular, and I think that we as a country need to look to government in some way to change policy and look at things that make us more accessible.
Can we have high security and high interactivity with this world of best and brightest students?
Oh, I believe so. I think that security and checking the students prior to coming is being done, checking students now, tracking what they're doing. Are they enrolled in the programs they're supposed to be enrolled in? Are they living where they're supposed to be living? All of those things are being done. So security is at a high level in terms of this particular piece of immigrants and non-immigrants in the United States, our visitors. in the U.S., this 2% of the population is being watched as closely as I think they need to be, perhaps more so.
It can be done, but will it be done? Lawrence Bell, stand by. Peggy Blumenthal, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Peggy Blumenthal with the Institute of International Education. Listeners, you can join the conversation tonight. If the global perception is that the United States simply isn't welcoming, how does that get changed? And could American students pick up the slack if foreign students go elsewhere? Or is that unrealistic? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's shrinking appeal to students from abroad and the price to the U.S. economy when the world's best and brightest stay home or go elsewhere. You can join the conversation tonight. Can the United States thrive without an open door to international students? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight from Boulder, Colorado, by Lawrence Bell, Director of International Education, the International Education Office at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and Vice President for Public Policy at NAFSA, the Association of International Educators. He testified recently before Congress on the declining number of international students in American universities. Joining us right now from Washington, D.C. is Tony Edson. He is Managing Director of Visa Services at the Bureau of Consular Affairs at the U.S. State Department. Tony Edson, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
So what went wrong in the last couple of years that led to these really sharp drop-offs in the flow of international students coming here? Was this an inevitable result of 9/11 and the kind of security clench that the United States went into afterward, or did we mess up?
Thanks for the question. I think that we need to look at, and I'm sure in the rest of the conversation you have been looking at, the other factors that lead, that feed into international education in the United States, the things that attract, make education here attractive to students, and the role that the visa process plays in that. I think what we're dealing with now largely is a problem of perceptions. A perception that the United States is less welcoming, a perception that the visa process is a tremendous hindrance to entry into the U.S. There were some delays associated with some of the changes made immediately after 9/11 for that first year, year and a half. Those delays are almost entirely a thing of the past now. Issuance procedures now are with the exception of the need to come in and apply in person because we're collecting two finger scans now. Mm-hmm. I think issuance procedures are relatively smooth, and in fact, in many cases, smoother than they were before 2001.
So the stories that we've heard over that time of scholars waiting months, sometimes maybe even a year before they could get in, missing out on research projects, can't come to conferences, can't participate, you know, brought back again and again, or at the U.S. border, interrogated, having all their names and addresses and phone numbers sort of siphoned off. I mean, there were real security issues here, but you're saying those things are not happening now.
I'm saying that actually when they happen, they're happening to a relatively small number. A lot of the focus has been on the special screening processes. These month-long delays are for special clearance or special screening that goes on for actually only 2.5% of the 7 to 9 million visa applicants we have every year. So any story about someone who's in that pool is almost of necessity. I mean, it's going to be a story about a very unrepresentative applicant in the visa pool. There have been delays. The delays were much worse before. Now we've gone, for example, the special screening process for certain types of sensitive technology issues. That's gone from an average of 75 days 2 years ago to less than 14 days today. And it's that kind of thing we've seen. I'm not saying the problems have all gone away, but it certainly was never our intention to prevent or even impede the entry of students and scholars into the United States. And I think that a lot has been done to make that process smooth.
Lawrence Bell, you hear Tony Edson saying they're working on it. It's getting better. We heard Robert Bergeneau, Chancellor at the University of California, say just a few minutes ago he's still concerned that there's a real impediment here. How do you see it? Do we have the right balance of
of security and openness? Do we have the right efficiency in the face that the United States shows global scholars?
Well, I certainly agree. I actually agree with both points of view, which is interesting. But I agree that with Tony that what was a terrible situation 2 years ago is now not such a bad situation. Unfortunately, many of those that are delayed longer than the 14 days, which is normal, are those that are in science and technology, and science and technology is one of the areas that's of great concern for Dr. Bergeneau. And so I think you can agree with both of those, that we have improved, but there are still further improvements that can be made and need to be made.
Let's turn to our callers. We've had a lot waiting. Gary's calling from Durham, North Carolina. Gary, you're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
My contention is that there are already too many PhDs in the biological sciences. Employment is very difficult to find. People complete their PhD and then do five-year postdocs at meager wages, and then often leave the sciences unable to find a job that employs the skills that they've gained.
So if the spigot of foreign students gets turned off, you say, fine, there are too many people in biomedical sciences already?
Yes.
Let us pick it up. Lawrence Bell, can you speak to that? I mean, here's a voice from one particular sector saying it's already crowded. We don't need this flow from abroad.
I'm not familiar with biotechnology, but I'm guessing that there are fields across the country where there may be an excess number of PhDs, and so job opportunities are limited. Those areas, however, I can't again speak for biotech, but in some of those areas there are controls that would prevent an international student from staying on in order to accept a job in that field if there were not enough positions available.
Tony Edson, does the State Department, in your screening, do you screen for sectors in which the United States has a real confirmed need for foreign scholars, or do you leave that up to universities, kind of supply and demand dynamic?
A lot of it is the market, of course, driving that, and the market probably goes both ways, although I'm not aware that specific information has, or specific research has been done, but I suspect that if we ran the numbers, we would find that certain fields are perhaps less attractive to foreign students when the economy in those particular sectors turns down. The employment, those skilled worker visas, the H visa category that was mentioned before, is an area where consideration is given to market forces in the petition adjudication process by DHS.
So you're looking for need among American employers. Let's get another call. Ravi's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Ravi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm actually from India, and I did my master's here in the United States. I just don't want to give the name of the university, though.
All right.
But one reason that I feel why this, the numbers have shrunk is because of the budget cut in the universities. Like most of us, we had to contend doing some kind of a part-time job on campus, and we never had an opportunity to really get involved in the research work by the professor. And not all the universities are up to the mark, except for a few premier institutions, like a few in California, and of course MIT, Harvard, and so on.
But you're saying budget cuts. You're saying budget cuts, Ravi, in American universities have left you wondering whether, as an Indian student, you needed or need to come to the U.S.
What happens is when there's when we have budget cuts, then the students who study here, we pass on the information to students back home, telling that, hey, once you come here, you're not going to get any scholarship or funding. You have to continue yourself working in probably a cafeteria or so. So that's how, the information passes on. And back home, we have a boom, the IT boom. So students there, they think, okay, why to go there and, do all that kind of work? I have a good, I could do an IT job here with this.
Stay in India, do that sort of work that they already want to be doing, and get an education, you're saying?
Yes, but again, most the again, as I said, most of the universities, they are not really up to the mark, especially the place where I studied. It's like probably that's a, like the biggest mistake I've done in my life.
Wow, wow. That's not a vote of confidence. Ravi, thanks for your call. Lawrence Bell, a couple of things there. I mean, on the one hand, lots of American students work their way through university. It's hard to cry big crocodile tears there. On the other hand, if the word going back to India and China is budget cuts are here, don't come to the U.S., you'll be working in a cafeteria and not getting that great an education anyway, stay in India, there's the competitive face of this.
Yes, obviously there are market forces at work, and if if there are budget cuts or cuts in funding for research in certain areas, students that previously had been funded won't be able to be funded, and so they may have to work on campus. And by the way, their employment is limited by various rules, so so that part of it is taken care of. But still, there are opportunities that may be lost because of budget cuts. So he's absolutely correct in that.
Sharmila's calling from New York. Hi, Sharmila. You're on the air.
Hi. I came as an international student in 2000, before September 11th, and I'm from Malaysia, so I can only really talk about what it was like to come from there.
Okay.
By 2000, there had been a big economic recession.
In the U.S., yes. The 90s bubble was going belly up.
In Asia. Because
the crisis there, right?
Malaysia. Between 98 and 2000, there was already a big economic disinclination to come to the United States, and Malaysian students started turning to the less expensive countries like Australia and even just going next door to Singapore for a better education.
Because the Malaysian economy was tanking, it was too expensive to come to the U.S.
Yes, and at that time, I believe the embassy in Malaysia used sort of a financial screening. For example, in order to come here, I had on the day of my application, I had with me 4 years of, whatever your tuition was left and expenses.
They wanted to know that you'd be able to support yourself. Is that reasonable? Did other countries do the same, Sharmila?
I don't know, but that's what they did in Malaysia. I had to have, as a cashier's check, so that's pretty much having it in cash, enough money to support myself for 4 years. So for rich families, and that was, that's always, if you were rich, you were able to study overseas. For rich families, that may have still been possible. For middle-class families, that really was a prohibitive thing.
A big thing to get over. Sharmila, let me ask you, if I may, Malaysia is a Muslim country. In your conversations with fellow Malaysians in the years since 9/11, do they feel that the United States, as Malaysian Muslims, do they feel the U.S. has remained welcoming?
Yes and no. It's still possible for students to come there, obviously, but there are many more. There's many more forms to fill out. There's much more waiting time. I was very recently at an American embassy in Malaysia. I was there last November, and I was treated very well. And applications were processed what seemed to me more efficiently than they had been in 2000 when I applied.
So something's going well. Sharmila, thanks for your call. Thanks very much for calling in. Tony Edson, there's a vote of confidence from maybe Kuala Lumpur.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, sounds like good to have that tonight. Let's get another call. Richard's calling from Little Rock, Arkansas. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. As you may know,
Richard, you're cutting out on us. Are you there, my friend? It sounds like a cell phone that's going right off the rails. Let's get another call here from Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Vebhoff is calling. Vebhoff, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm Vebhoff, and I'm, I want to just, first of all, let me say that I really do not agree 100% with what we are discussing over here, that visa and security is one of the major issues which are distracting students from coming to U.S.
So what do you see as the main reason?
I will even not put it that these are the main reasons, but I just want to put few new dimensions into this discussion that somewhat was covered in Ravi's word, which was one of the prior callers.
Yes.
We are outsourcing our jobs to India, IT jobs to India, and I don't know what quantity is going to China. I, being an Indian, I know how much is going to India, okay? These kind of stuff, I mean, back in India, students used to be attracted to come to U.S. to work for Intel, to work for Oracle, IBM, blah, 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 all these brands. But you name a brand and you get it there back in India today. I mean, I can work for any company which is over here for a good, handsome pay back in India.
So it's a global economy. The companies you might have come here to work for are right there in India, not the same incentive to come. Vipoff, thanks for your call. Lawrence Bell, long-term, with luck, the U.S. figures out how to balance its security interests and the open door. But there's that challenge from economies and, along with them, academic institutions growing abroad. I heard recently that Japan now has more Chinese graduate students than the United States. I can't verify that 100%, but I heard it from a pretty good source. And China itself building institutions, India itself building institutions and having lots of economic opportunity. Can the U.S. regain its status as the sort of unrivaled center for university graduate education, or is it just going to have to share?
Oh, I believe very definitely it can regain. I do think, though, it would take a concerted effort on the part of some selected government agencies, the Department of Commerce, the Department of State, Homeland Security, as well as a number of academic institutions and perhaps some of the professional associations for higher education, in order to gather the stakeholders and develop a national plan for how to deal with this.
A plan that would speak to what problems, what issues?
Access for international students, as well as market forces that may be driving some away or pulling some away.
And can, you're saying, a kind of coalition of government and academic sources that has a strategy. Are other countries doing that right now, countries the U.S. is competing with for the best and the brightest?
Very definitely. Canada, for example, is doing that with both in industry, academe, and government offices working toward developing ways to pull international students into Canada. The UK is doing that through the British Council and other countries. Germany is doing that with developing English language programs for graduate students to pull them from other places because they realize English is an important draw. So yes, other countries are very definitely doing this, and by not doing it, we're losing the competitive advantage we used to have.
Sounds like it's time for the United States to be fully in the game. Lawrence Bell at the University of Colorado at Boulder, Vice President for Public Policy at NAFSA, the Association of International Educators. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And Tony Edson, joining us from Washington, D.C. tonight, Managing Director of Visa Services at the Bureau of Consular Affairs at the U.S. State Department. Good luck with all your far-flung offices there, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Sure. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.